Pentagon asking God to pour down overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. Can you talk about how the Pope responded when he said, even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Pope Leo said that.
Yeah, God is a God of life. This idea that some people don't deserve mercy is completely against the Christian message. So on pretty much every measure, it fails as a Christian message. Calling down violence against somebody, saying that someone doesn't deserve mercy, saying that God is only on our side. I mean, it's a real perversion of the Gospels.
I want to thank you, Father James Martin, Jesuit priest, editor-at-large of America Magazine, author of the new book, Work in Progress. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking today after the 1:30 screening of Steal the Story, Please! At the IFC in the Village. We'll be doing the Q&A with the co-director, Carl Diehl. I'll also be speaking tonight at the Q&A after the screening of the film at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. Tomorrow we head to Los Angeles, where we'll be at the different Lemley theaters, and then to San Francisco this weekend to be at the Roxy in San Francisco, at the Rialto in San Rafael, and in Berkeley. You can go to democracynow.org to see all the details. This is the first week of Steal the Story, Please! The film screening around the country. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them, and not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
Hi, this is Al McFarlane, host of The Conversation with Al McFarlane. You're listening to 98.3 FM, KFAI, Minneapolis. I'm Al McFarland. Welcome to The Conversation with Al McFarland. I'm glad to be here and glad to have you along as well. As always, I promise a robust conversation, a good program today. And as you know, of late, we've been writing about the legislature, about getting our community to pay attention to what our interests are and how do we advocate for the things we need in community for the best and most responsible use of our tax dollars and for a sense of justice, equity, economic development. Well, I thought I would reach out to some of the legacy institutions in Twin Cities to get a sense of how the discussions taking place over in St. Paul and how the general environment, given the federal administration's clampdown against DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, whether that's even a factor in the future development of community. And so today I had the pleasure of connecting with one of the leaders of one of the legacy institutions in Twin Cities. Kimberly Spates is CEO of North Point Health and Wellness. And North Point is an anchor institution for North Minneapolis on the corner of Plymouth and Penn, a brand new, newly renovated medical and social service facility and administrative center in the Regional Acceleration Center. This development of North Point in North Minneapolis has been the anchor for the reemergence of that corner of Plymouth and Penn, where we have North Point, we have Estes Funeral Chapel, we have the Minneapolis Urban League or Urban League of Twin Cities, and we have a block away the University of Minnesota, Yurok Center. So a lot of good things happening in North Minneapolis. But my question, Kimberly, thank you for being here. First of all, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for the invite. McFarland, it's great to be here today.
Sure. I'm going to bring one person who's kind of co-piloting with me today, okay. And that's Anthony Taylor. Anthony is active in community. You and he go back as well. Anthony, yes. Good to see you, my friend. And I know you got to leave at 11:30 or 12:30 at the bottom of the hour, but join me in this conversation. Kimberly, start with you, if you would. Give people, you know, North Point 101. What is North Point? What's the value proposition? And what is the mission and role in community?
All right. Thank you so much for that question. So North Point Health and Wellness Center is a federally qualified healthcare center that has been in North Minneapolis for over 55 years. A lot of folks remember Pilot City, which was born out of the civil rights movement and some of the unrest and discontent for our African-American families, business owners back in 1968. And they came together and said, no, we don't need anybody to figure this out for us. We'll figure it out for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so created this anchor institution that provides medical, dental, behavioral health, and human services to over 25,000 individuals annually. Our mission is partnering to create a healthier community. So a lot of things that we do are really to amplify our partners' voices, not just ours. Our real focus is to stabilize individuals, but also to ensure that their health and well-being is paramount. And so for North Point, we are excited about the opportunities that the expansion provided at the corner of Penn and Plymouth. We were a catalyst in ensuring that other anchor institutions like Estes Funeral Home, who's been in our community for, I don't know, 70 plus years, if not more, was able to get a new chapel, which has now provided some additional stabilization and economic development and support for that organization, as well as you mentioned, the regional accelerator building we call 1256. That's the number, which provides, we have a number of businesses like Meta, Build Wealth. Build Wealth is one of the owners in the building, as well as North Point Health and Wellness Center is in the building, as well as the county. And there are a number of services that are provided there. But I think what people need to understand is, you know, North Point still has a stake in ownership in the community. And our job is really to ensure that we help to catalyze what everyone else is doing. Like, we stay in our lane around health and wellness, but we also try to connect with others to ensure that our community gets all of the things that they need and have access to information, to resources, but also just to build community.
You know, tell us about your staff. How large an organization are you? I think you're one of the larger employers in North Minneapolis. Am I correct?
That is correct. We are one of the larger employers. We have about, in total, almost 450 employees between our entire organization. We have a nonprofit, the Human Services, that provides, we served over 100,000 people in our food shelf last year. And a number of other wraparound services. And then we have about 350 to 400 individuals who work in our clinical services area, providing, as I've said, you know, medical appointments. We have a lab, we have a pharmacy, behavioral health, optometry, all those additional services. So, yes, we are a large employer on the north side.
I wanted to have you take a minute to explain to our community, our listeners, how the ICE presence impacted our community. I think most of us were, you know, kind of watching what happened in South Minneapolis with the two shootings over there, and we watched the protests happening. But I don't know if our neighborhood has a sense of ICE in North Minneapolis and how it impacts organizations like yours. What's the story?
Yeah, so during this ICE surge here, we saw a stark decline in individuals coming in for their just basic routine services. We have dental, which is, you know, there's not a lot of dental services around in North Minneapolis. We're one of the only. And we anticipate people coming in. We have a wait list. It's hard to get in. And so our dental director, Dr. Brooks, was telling me about a person who had paid their like $3,000 for their dentures. And during ICE, they wouldn't come in. They paid it, but they just wouldn't come. And so the individual's level of fear about being harassed or deported impacted our ability to deliver service. It also impacted our, you know, our revenue right? If we don't see patients, we don't get paid. And then that impacts our ability to continue to provide services at a level that we would like. I think also what people also miss sometimes is the impact on staff. Because we have a very culturally diverse staff. Mm-hmm. And they experienced the ICE surge as well, from even their own impact to themselves as well to impact to their families. And so we had to do some shifting in how we provided services in behavioral health and medical. We provided opportunities for telehealth so people could call or do like we're doing today, mm-hmm. on a virtual call to ensure they still had access to their services. And then we just had to wait, right? And we also just try to provide a level of sense of safety for individuals. So we utilized our tools and social media as well as word of mouth that we're still open and available. And we are starting to see folks coming back, but there mm-hmm. still needs to be this kind of re-engagement and reassurance for individuals that we do provide a very safe space for individuals to receive care.
How is what's the funding model for mm-hmm. North Point? What's the revenue stream or revenue basis for it? Are you county? Are you city? Are you state? And I raised the question to have us look at, and maybe Anthony will jump in, and I think Justin Terrell's yeah. in the studio too. What's our relationship with the state and county and city mm-hmm. funding streams? And are those being impacted in any way by the the Trump administration's bearing down on mm-hmm. saying that the government hasn't got a role to play in things like daycare and that states should do that. And now we got our state in a state of paralysis right now because of this massive fraud paranoia. And so how does that impact your organization?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a little complicated, so I'm going to try to make it simple. I will try. So as you all know, North Point has, some folks know, we have two distinct organizations, our nonprofit, like I said earlier, that does a lot of our health and human services wraparound services. So there are a lot of revenue that we get from county sources, from state sources through grants and contracts, but we also raise money through philanthropic means. So that's one source of revenue for us. And then on the clinical side, we are a federally qualified healthcare center, which means that we get an enhanced rate from Medicaid for patients who qualify for that. But we also get supplemental support from the federal government to supply, to ensure that we are able to provide services to anyone, regardless of their ability to pay. And so this enhanced rate that we get helps in some respects to cover some of those uncompensated care costs for us. And so that complicated model comes with a relationship with Hennepin County. We have a co-applicant agreement. So the county provides support when it comes to our building and our staffing, but the operations of the organization are managed and decisions are made by our community board, mm-hmm. which is made up of 51% patients, who are people from the community who receive the services, who are impacted by the services. And so that's where the balance comes in when we kind of talk about what's the impact to the community. We have folks that look like those who come to us for service, making the decisions about what services we provide, where we provide them, how we provide them, and who we provide them to. So that's how we kind of try to balance things out as far as like our revenue sources. So we've got Medicare, Medicaid, we take commercial insurance as well. And then we provide options for individuals who do not have insurance, right? I want people to really hear me and understand that just because you don't have insurance does not mean you don't have access to care. Mm. North mm. Point was specifically set up in this model to ensure that you could come. If you're a small business owner, and you can't afford MedShare on the marketplace, but we have a sliding scale based on your income. Or, you know, some people don't want to share their information, which we understand, especially mm-hmm. given the level of oversight from the federal government and how people utilize our information. Mm-hmm. So and we have another way you can pay. We have a self-pay, but there's still there's some discount to that. So this was created as an option for everyone. And sometimes I think people think about, oh, this is just a free clinic. Well, economics 101, there's no such thing as a free lunch. And there's always a way in which we try to work with people to pay their bills. I want people to not be afraid to come for service, because it costs you more to not get that abscess tooth looked at or not get that sore looked at on your leg than to come in and say, look, I just don't have it today. How can I make a payment arrangement to pay for my services?
And actually, it costs the city and the county more as well. You don't get the service that you're eligible for, that you can, you know, work out a payment plan on. That problem escalates and is going to be more serious and more dangerous, both perhaps in your life, but also in your costs for treating a situation. So, let me bring Anthony Taylor in here. Anthony Taylor, and I think Justin Terrell is in the back room. If he's not, he'll be here in a second. Anthony, good to see you as always. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing well, thank you.
Yeah, well, so join me in the conversation. You and I go back in this town a long, long time, and you work in the wellness space through the Cultural Wellness Center in South Minneapolis. You're an advocate for fitness and outdoors and engagement, and you also are involved now in developing business activities along the river in North Minneapolis. When you look at the overall future of North Minneapolis, how critical is it to have institutions like North Point grow and be sustainable, at the same time support the entrepreneurial and wealth building initiative of our community as well? What do you think?
Well, I will say I love North Point. I'm a former board member, as well as my mother was a former board member, and of course North Point. Matter of fact, fun fact: North Point was an original funder of the Major Taylor Bicycling Club when we first started, and so continue to have that relationship. So North Point is critical at the North Side. And what I want to say is that what Kimberly said was really important. They are the number one employer in North Minneapolis. I think that there, I don't think there's anybody else who employs 500 people in the geography of what we, you know, say is North Minneapolis. So I think the thing that I see is that there's North Point, and there's an industry around that. Healthcare is a growing industry. There's workforce development opportunities there. That is, as North Point works very hard to pay their team members what I'm calling family sustaining wages, which, you know, that's the thing for me. I think that wealth generation and wealth is too abstract. The bottom line is growing community members' median household income. Part of that ties them to an important thing, which is healthcare. So, I mean, it costs. Healthcare is a real cost. And so I think really important message around that North Point has an option for those who have chosen not to have insurance or unable to have insurance because the economics work, right? So it's a really important message that families take that on and take advantage of that resource. But I do think that, as Kimberly talked about, that this is a $50 million development. I think those are real numbers, people. I think that when we talk about development, it is not a small thing. So $50 million developed there is important. What I'm hoping for is a much more complementary kind of outcome, because I do think that North Point is critical. We need an additional $50 million to develop around the business side, creating more jobs to match that. And I think that this is kind of our struggle right now, is that we have a overinvestment. Everybody you named, Estes is a small, long-term business, viable to the community, but UROC, Build Wealth, Meta, none of those add value in a community in a way that we can speak to. And so I think we always have a challenge there where we have to do both of those things at the same time. And if all the growth in what we provide in North Minneapolis is a service, you know, then I think then that's where we're not growing a balanced pie in terms of the reality of who lives in North Minneapolis, the identity of North Minneapolis, and the bottom line is the economy of North Minneapolis, because there is an economy there, and that's our challenge.
Justin Terrell is joining us. Justin is with the Minnesota Justice Research Center, and we've been between Anthony and Justin and I kicking some ideas back and forth over the past several weeks, having to do with the questions I have raised at Inside News about whether or not North Minneapolis or Black Twin Cities is getting its fair share, its fair treatment by the legislature, particularly in this environment where there is, it seems, a call for intense scrutiny on legislation or funding for Black-controlled, Black-managed solutions. And I had compared the history of the state's investment, direct investment in the Black community to the state's direct investment to the Iron Range. And the Iron Range was like a beautiful case in point because without hesitation, our state rallied to reduce, eliminate, respond to the pain that the white people who live on the Iron Range were feeling during the economic cycles for that community. So the question is, can we do the same thing in Twin Cities for the Black community? Justin, let me have you jump in here. What do you think is an appropriate role for a state in supporting economic and cultural and social and health development for a community? What do you think?
I think it's, well, first of all, thank you for having me, and I've been having some tech issues, so I appreciate the patience. But I think it's a critical role for government. So government should enforce the contracts between its people and also provide for the well-being of its people, and so, or create pathways for the well-being of its people. And so then obviously safety is the other big part of the social contract. And so I think that you know, in this country, we're very comfortable with talking about, you know, physical violence or other types of violence, but we struggle to talk about economic violence, which is how I would interpret the actions that have been carried out in regards to our community in the throughout the history of Minnesota. Whatever we built gets dismantled. Whatever we whatever ideas, especially during my time at the state of Minnesota at the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, you know, whatever ideas that we brought up, we knew we had to sell it as what's good for us is good for everyone, because there anything that prioritizes the well-being of our community specifically tends to get watered down and attached to or other things attached to it in a way where the original purpose gets misunderstood in a lot of ways. And so, I mean, we can use specific examples. So at the same time you tear down Rondo, you build Roseville, right? So like one community gets dismantled, another community literally gets developed, right? I think the Iron Range is a perfect example, but I also think of how governments will invest. I look at the Crosby-Ironton neighborhood, how the governments and local businesses have worked together to create a tourist area around the previous mining infrastructure that was there. And it's great. Like, I love going to that area. But we haven't seen that kind of sustained investment or efforts in the Black community, especially in North Minneapolis or in South Minneapolis, 38th Street Corridor, Camden Town, Reconnect Rondo. These are all projects that I imagine will take another 50 years before we figure out how to make them meaningful economic engines of our community or destinations for our culture.
I have often said that, you know, using my grandmother's mother wit, I made the statement that we have to see our health as our business. And I fully mean the double entendre. Grandma would say, mind your business, boy. You know, mind your business, right? But our business is our health. Our health is our business. And we need to be able to frame the business of good health, of wellness, in a way that we are conscious of the revenue streams associated with the business of health. So, you know, I say, like everybody else, I would love to be able to take a pill that prevents cancer in my body, right? But until that pill is produced, organizations like Mayo Clinic, you know, ingest and get the investment of millions upon millions upon millions upon millions of problem-solving dollars. They've turned the problem into a project, an opportunity. We are often characterized by the deficits we experience both personally and collectively as community. I think we need to turn that around and attach an awareness of the investment required to keep our health business viable. Anthony, you made a statement about, you know, the value that organizations like the university and I think you said Urban League, which are nonprofits, add to the community. Go with that a little bit more, because I'm wondering what is the proper balance equation that strengthens those resources while also strengthening our economic development. It's not an either or for me. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think it's either or. You know, one thing I'm going to back up a little bit on the Iron Range conversation, for example, because I think that one of the things we have to realize is that the Iron Range in North Minneapolis have something in common. They were both built on an extractive economy. That in Iron Range, it was an extractive economy related to the soil, and the people then reaped a benefit and lost their health. So we, you know, in North Minneapolis, it was an extractive economy based on the labor of the people. It is not separate from what we have seen during the enslavement, Jim Crow, and then it shows up in a void. At some point, the void, right, the value is taken away. So there's something there. The thing with the Iron Range is that they have rebuilt the reason for investment based on a future economy. What we have done in North Minneapolis sometimes, and particularly as we look at it, is that we have justified the investment based on the disparity. The lead headline is African-American disparity, and that is a justification for it. That is not a justification. They're not down with that. When you are racist, you believe that what we see as a disparity is actually the quality of who you are as a human living itself out, right? So we lose that battle. And I think that actually is, I love it that Justin has gone up to those places. I mean, we are going on vacation. We are heading up there for the experience of being in the great outdoors and taking that tour of the mind, right? And so it's a weird thing that what I am saying in terms of health is that I really do think that we have to build this on the value of contribution of Black life, the value of Black life, that every one of these businesses, and I count North Point as a business, as a strong, viable business, that we have to measure the outcome and their ability to actually deliver the change that we want. And that's what I'm kind of saying in terms of value. If median household income is not growing in North Minneapolis, that's a problem. And everybody who's getting paid for workforce development, we need to go visit them. If health improvement is not going up in North Minneapolis, and what's happening for Kimberly is that the perception is that North Point represents low health. Matter of fact, they are doing some of the best work in the city. And so you know what I'm saying? So Mayo Clinic is built on people who have the most choice are choosing Mayo Clinic. We have created a situation where people who have the least choice are choosing North Point. And what that becomes is the actual inability to create the change, because every time somebody gets healthy, they move down the street and go to Northern Memorial in Golden Valley. Not the one on Broadway Avenue, but the one on 169, right? So what happens is we continue to do this thing where we're actually compiling the challenge in the geography of North Minneapolis. Because remember, the greatest predictor of low health is zip code. The greatest predictor of low income is zip code, right? So what we've done in terms of the way we've built this is we have defined a geography, right? That we have justified investments in based on the disparity, whether it's housing, whether it's workforce, whether it's healthcare, or whether it's education. And we got to turn that around. And I actually believe it starts with North Point, because healthcare is a leading indicator in terms of quality of life, right? And so there's a way for us to reframe this that really gets to the crux of it. And that's value, Al. That's what I mean by value. The value of properties, the value of the way we see our young people, the quality of our schools, and measuring them in real terms. That's value. And if more nonprofits is not value, because they're there to solve a problem. And if the you know what I'm saying? Like, that's the justification. More problem, more this, more that. And I think that that's the mistake of how I see it.
Kimberly, jump in. What do you, as you hear us kicking it, yeah. How do you see North Point weighing and leading in this arena?
Yeah, Mr. Taylor talked about it resonates with me because, you know, we work in this county environment where everything is being driven by this notion of being less than. I mean, we had to wait almost 20 years, right, to argue and fuss and fight about building a new building at the corner where we are now, right? It took that long. But our community showed up in that last, 2018, they showed up downtown and said, you're going to do this, right? Because it's necessary for our community's health and well-being. And when your zip code determines what your value, then I feel like it's our job to ensure that we are increasing that value. So a lot of the things that we are working on now is really trying to do some of this compassionate accountability, I guess, to say it, to like, yes, you can come to North Point. It's not a free clinic, though. Mm-hmm. We have services here that are of a value. We value you. You should value the service. So when you pay for a service, you tend to then put more energy and effort into, well, what do I want to get out of it? So we just started there, and that took a long time. I had a lot of staff that was mad and, you know, people complaining. It's like, yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you want us to still be here for you, for your mom, for your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and we need you to invest in your own well-being, right? Because once you do that, then we can help you navigate the rest of it. And it's really not navigation. It's really, here's the skinny. Like, this is what's happening. Just like when all of the evictions were happening. North Minneapolis was the epicenter. I was at a meeting, and I was like, well, y'all talking about where I work and live. You can't go around us. You got to come right here, right? Mm-hmm. You got to come here and you got to help us figure out how we're going to stabilize this community and provide opportunities for people to now get the down payment that they need to get the house that they want. So a lot of our programs have evolved over time from really moving from just emergency crisis response. Yes, we know people are in that space, but now we're really trying to look at, how do we help people stabilize and then look at now that I've stabilized, what's next? Not just I just want to sit here because now I can pay my rent every day and I can get my kids to school on time. But now it's like, now that I've done that, what's next for me? And trying to help people drive to that next place, because you know, the things around us don't value us, but we've always been able to take care of ourselves and our people, regardless of what's happening around us sometimes. And I think we have to start to lean into that ingenuity. I call it African ingenuity. That's my word. That we have to start leaning into that and not being afraid of it. I know the federal government talks about DEI. We have never talked about, not necessarily in those terms. We just talked about, this is our stuff. You can't take it. We're going to do what we need to do for our people. And if you'd like to come along, fine. But there are rules of engagement that you are going to have to follow to ensure that we get what we need. Because when we do well, everybody else does well, too. But first, we have to start with us. So,
you know, what I'm hearing is a need for us to examine the narrative. You know, and because two things happened here. One, Alan, Anthony, you talked about the description, the definition of the playing field as one that's deficit-driven, disparity-driven. But Kimberly, I heard you saying, I'm not concerned about how y'all describing things outside. I'm concerned about the positivity of improving, increasing, supporting growth, development, quality of life for individuals that I serve, both from the medical and health component and the social service component. So definition is there. And Justin, jump in here. How do we begin to frame then our conversations in ways that allow us to not be at odds with ourselves on our requirements to develop, but that allow us to expand on all fronts simultaneously, effectively, in a coordinated, cooperative, collaborative manner. Justin, what do you think?
I think this conversation is a good example of that. So like I run a nonprofit, right? The Minnesota Justice Research Center is a nonprofit, and I think we add an extreme amount of value to the community, right? We're not a service organization, and so I have the same I have the same critique of most service organizations that operate from this like sort of deficit disparity narrative. And I'll be the first to say that, like, yeah, whatever racial disparity people want to talk about, show me one that we've actually resolved. And if there's a list, it's a very short list, right? Like, these are talking points for people to sort of maintain the status quo. We know the status quo isn't good for our people. We have to put together strategies and narratives and conversations that break through the status quo and actually help us to sort of like reimagine and imagine what's possible, which is the work we do in related to the criminal legal system, so that we can get relieve some of that pressure off of Black folks' necks, so that they have the space to be like, hey, I'm gonna run up to North Point, right, and get this thing checked out, right, or you know, take advantage of some of the other opportunities that we offer each other within our community. And so, I do think the threat to some of the progress that I see as possible is that you know, we have loud voices in our community that and then we have voices that are louder to the white gaze, right? And so often on social media, I'm entertained by Black folks who are saying things like, what about us? What about me? How come no one's talking about what I did? And that to me is just a little embarrassing. But it's fair, because we know that in order to move resources to our community, we have often had to chase the white gaze. And as an executive director of a nonprofit, you know, I'm thankful for people like Shonda Smith Baker and people like Quentin Williams at the Joyce Foundation and Sarah down at Minneapolis Foundation, Patrice. And I can keep naming Black folk, Kedar Hickman, like in Black folks in philanthropy who do support the work of Black nonprofit leaders. But let's be honest, when you're going for that state money or some of the other philanthropic groups, you have to perform for the white gaze. And so there's a lot of, I hope people understand what I mean by the white gaze.
You should explain that. What do you mean by that?
Just this idea that, you know, a lot of our issues in our community take off and get more notoriety when white folks are paying attention to them.
And you mean G-A-Z-E.
Their eye gaze. Yeah, when their eyes are upon our issue, right?
Yeah.
And how they interpret our issue through their cultural lens is really how it gets passed out to a national court conversation. And so we have to build the ability through groups like Insight News, through the spokesman, through, you know, Black Press, through all these, we have to build our own conversation within our own community that then we can fuel with more viewers and more resources, which equals power in my evaluation, so that we can actually start to lead our own conversation. If I go to one more policy discussion about, you know, the future of the state, And they're talking about Black issues, and I don't hear any mention of reparations, and I don't hear any mention of the work that we've done on the criminal legal system in this state to make sure that we don't end up like that, make sure North Minneapolis doesn't end up like parts of Milwaukee, which is the most incarcerated zip code in the country. If I don't hear those kind of that kind of language and spaces of power and these policy and these funder conversations, I know that's ultimately not a place for us, right? They're not lifting up the issues that directly impact us. And so in that respect, I'm not begging for their attention. Like, we have to do what North Point is, frankly, is a great example of, as in what you, frankly, are a great example of, is how we use our people power and the financial resources that we do have, because don't sleep, Black folks do have money. I've raised more money as an organizer from church ladies with big hats, you know, on Sunday, right? Like, we the money is there, and so is the charitable giving. It's just around, how do we build infrastructure around it? How do we build a sustained infrastructure and sustained strategies where everyone doesn't have to run in the same lane, but we appreciate everybody running in their own lanes? I'm not going to work on healthcare. I'm thankful to God above and whatever power in the universe you may appreciate the most, that Kimberly is working on healthcare, because that's not my lane. But I do make sure that when I am working with folks in the community and I know that they got a health issue, that I do direct them to North Point, right? Not for a free clinic, but for a service that is definitely in their interest.
Anthony and Kimberly, talk about the question of power. How do we become aware of our individual and collective power? How do we organize, mobilize, and produce results that support our viewpoint, our interest, our desire to be of consequence in community? Anthony, what do you think? And then Kimberly?
Well, you know, I think that they you know, Brother Justin and Kimberly both touched on something important. And in some regards, Kimberly specifically used the phrase mutual aid. Talking about this idea, he talked about the church ladies. I mean, I know again that I point to the historical reality that before there was, you know, what we used to call social service, there was an instinct of providing mutual aid in the community. You know, that was, you know, important, and it was self-actualized, self-funded, self-directed, and so the ability to organize across lanes is one of the things I would say that's really important, right? Is that there is a way where we are working in a coordinated way in criminal justice, in housing, in healthcare, in economic development, you know, in philanthropy, in government, because we really do. You need coordinated support to move things forward, right? And that power, and I think the other thing is that the power base that we're building in different areas, we have to bring that to bear in kind of our shared spaces. So right now, what's happening with, and Kimberly is right in the middle of it, I'm sure, what's happening in the legislature with HCMC, that also includes North Memorial, which North Point is right in the middle of those two points, right? That through line from HCMC to North Point to North Memorial is real. And that is and that's a challenge. And I mm-hmm. think, but again, we all need to be aligned around from making sure that we close the gap on that need. And that, you know, you mentioned the $100 million, you know, thing. This 1% sales tax re-coordination is really a big deal, and it's something that we all should be paying attention to and getting behind and making sure it happens, because HCMC is critical to our community care.
Kimberly, talk about HCMC. Yeah. What's happening in the news? Give people a summary, and then how does that affect mm-hmm. us here in North Minneapolis and you?
So HCMC is a level one trauma center that provides high levels of care, emergency care, not just for the county, but also the state, with the hyperbaric chamber. As you all saw when the shooting happened at Annunciation, they showed up, and that's where a lot of the trauma individuals show up, because of the care that they provide. HCMC is also a teaching hospital, right? So that's where a lot of our next generation of practitioners train. And so it's a state resource for both health, well-being, but also as training. And so for us at North Point, we're all a part of this Hennepin County Accountable Care Organization, mm-hmm. which means that the county has a health plan that supports mostly low-income individuals. We have the hospital, and we have North Point as a primary care provider. And so we need the hospital to be able to refer individuals who might need a higher level of care, might need a specialist like a cardiologist or a pulmonologist or a neurologist. And so having that direct ability to refer directly, make sure that the person's care is coordinated at HCMC is necessary. It's a requirement for the funding that we get from the federal government as well, that we have a referral source in the hospital. Now, with North Memorial, they're very close to us. We have referral relationships with them as well, but HCMC is our partner because it's part of the Hennepin County ecosystem around healthcare. And so right now, as you see across the nation, hospitals are struggling to stay afloat because mm-hmm. of a lot of the changes that are happening at the federal level, what the federal level will pay for, and then what now has to be paid for by either at a state level or a local level. And as you noted earlier, Minnesota is kind of in the spotlight right now of continuous onslaught of, you know, questioning everything that gets done. This is fraud, this is isn't that. So a lot of the things that happen at HCMC and all of these changes disrupts their flow of revenue, because they serve same similar population that we do. Most of them are most individuals that go there are on public programs. So you're not getting the full reimbursement anyway, if you get a reimbursement at all. And so with this sales tax, really looking for a dedicated source of funding to support this healthcare system, especially at the hospital. So we need the hospital to be viable so that our folks in North Minneapolis can get the specialized care that they need, so that we can stay in our lane, as we talked about. We're talking about lanes today. So we can stay in our lane around primary care so they have a place to come back to maintain their health and wellness once they've, you know, seen the cardiologist and now have to have some stent put in. Or, but how do you care for that stent? And how do you continue to go back to your primary care provider every 3 months to ensure that the medications are working and that you have access to our pharmacy so those medications don't cost you $1,200. They only cost you maybe $15 or $20. Mm-hmm. So we need that balance in this ecosystem around health so that our folks can make sure that they have the access they need when they need it.
Okay, Justin, any thoughts on there?
I don't know that I have much to add other than HCMC also does a lot of research. And so there's you know, it's a massive enterprise. And so we need to protect it, not just for the services, once again, but right. Like for, exactly. For the research, for the education, the training that you brought up, right? The other roles that it plays in our community as well. And so we got to figure it out. I will say that my annoyance with this issue is that an institution that is that important to the fabric, the physical infrastructure of the city and to how people go about getting services, health services in the city, the fact that it kind of has been looming for all these years and we've lacked the ability to sort of like proactively get ahead of the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, that speaks to a bigger issue. I do know that there's a lot that's out of their control when the federal government does some of the crazy stuff it's been doing. But we should be trying to make sure institutions like that are in the strongest position.
Kimberly, do you all have a 10-year, 15, 20-year plan for North Point? Have we developed that kind of a muscle in the community already?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked. We just finished our strategic planning process. My board just completed and approved the strategic plan. We're taking it in smaller chunks in like 3-year span of time because we know this healthcare landscape changes all the time, right? Yeah. Right now we're going through, you know, trying to prepare for October when the new changes to Medicaid, the eligibility requirements happen, and then in beginning of 2027 when SNAP eligibility also changes. So we're building in kind of this ability to check in every year or so, if not more, to be sure that we are really focused on and have our finger on the pulse of what's really happening. So a lot of the planning that we're doing is really focused on ensuring that we can continue to provide this whole person integrated care model, right? So that individuals who come to us, we see the whole person, kind of back to this power question you talked about earlier, and how do we now prepare them after they leave us that they know how to get a job, they know where to go if they want to buy a home, or how they can manage their relationship with their landlord, or they know to go see Justin Terrell if they have some legal issues that they still need to resolve. And so we're really trying to lean into what our history has been and to not stray away from what the community needs, right? Because a lot of the things that we do really goes along with where the community is, because we are community focused. As I said earlier, we have 51% of our board is made up of community members. So I think it's going to be important over the next year and a half that individuals educate themselves about the healthcare system, about how government works, right? Because a lot of people don't know. They just get their tax bill and say this tax bill is high, right? Yes, it's going to be if you own a home, especially in Hennepin County or in Minneapolis. Yes, and now potentially you have another sales tax that you're going to have to pay if you're in Hennepin County. Like, those things you need to understand how they work and how they impact you, so that if it doesn't work for you, that you know who your representative is. So you can pick up the phone, or you can send an email, or you can show up at a town hall. Because the more we show up and are informed, the more those who are in power have to you know, make some different decisions. And I think when we say, no, this it doesn't work for me, then we get the people in place that we want to have in place to help us. But we have to be educated. We have to understand the power that we actually have. Mm-hmm. Because as you see now in the change in leadership at the top level, you know, folks are finding their voice. Some of us are not using it, right? Because we told you before this happened that what was going to happen is happening now. And it's like, well, sometimes you just got to sit in that. But for us, understanding the voice that we have, we use it, right? Mm-hmm. We had some questions about, you know, how this sales tax thing was going to work, or how, even with voting rights, right? We bring the right people to the table to help answer the questions. So then people can say, okay, now I know, I feel like I have a way in which to make a decision now. So as we think about North Point's role and as it has been for the past 56 plus years, it really is to be able to gather information and give that information back to people in a way that makes sense for them during the time frame that they need it. So then they can take it. And we encourage people, like, show up. My board, I ask them to show up in places and spaces. They show up and they know what we prepare them. They know what to say. And people listen, right? Because now they're talking to a constituent, right? They're talking to a potential voter, right? Mm-hmm. For what's happening in the area, or someone who can show up and change the trajectory of something that's happening at the state or local level. So I feel like we've done our job when our people show up in spaces that maybe they didn't always feel like they were welcome, but they still show up anyway.
Justin, what about it showing up? You know, that's something that is foundational. And so let's say we end up getting the message that our people, the light bulb goes off broadly through the community, young people, older people, people that might not have been intentionally engaged. You know, if that happens, what changes? If we show up at our maximum level, what will change in community?
Yeah, well, first of all, I got to plug what Kimberly is talking about. So tomorrow, actually at 10:30, we'll be rallying at the Capitol Rotunda for Justice for All Day on the Hill. So if folks want to come and experience, you know, if you want to show up and learn a little bit more about criminal justice issues, you want to talk to your legislator, you just want to be in the Capitol space to figure out how it operates, we'll be there tomorrow morning rallying in the rotunda to talk about advancing some pretty common sense criminal justice issues like pretrial bail data, which passed out of committee today, which is exciting for us to know. Do Black folks pay higher bails? Do we pay lower bails? Do we get stuck in jail longer? All those type of things are what we're trying to work on. But to your question about what's possible, that's like the best question. So Adrienne Marie Brown says that all organizing is science fiction. And that's where I get excited, because it's not up to me or anyone on this call to say, to paint a picture of the future of what's possible and try to get everybody there. The exercise is actually much different. It's about getting us together, you know, at a hyper local community grassroots way to really start figuring out what are the intersections and where do we have opportunities to make a difference. I think development is one. I think healthcare is another. I think on education, we have showed and demonstrated success in our community and what we can do. And we've also been targeted, dismantled, and hit with multiple scandals because of that success. And so it's like, we have to be careful how we start to build these strategies. I think step number one is really just holding space to actually imagine what's possible. I will give you my like 30 seconds on the criminal legal system, what I think is possible. Yeah. I think we can shrink the footprint of law enforcement and make them extremely good at solving crimes, as opposed to all the other things we've poured into law enforcement through the 90s and early 2000s. I think law enforcement should be really good at solving crimes, should have strong relationships with communities to be able to solve those crimes, and that public safety is more of a responsibility that everybody shares in versus us always trying to make it somebody else's issue. I think in doing that, what we have is safe communities with low numbers of involvement from the system, which there are tons of those communities across the state. They just so happen to be filled with white folks. And so we can actually build as hyper safe local communities in the Black community where it's, you know, primarily there's upward mobility economically, we have economic safety and people are thriving. We have our schools are well, and we frankly set a model for what a middle class and thriving, you know, upward mobility society in the Black community looks like for the rest of the country. And people can look at us like we're crazy because they're like, ain't no Black folks in Minnesota. But we know that's not the case. And as far as long as people ain't paying attention, that gives us an opportunity to build something. But I do think step number one is just like creating space to imagine what's possible. And frankly, giving credit to some of the success that we have already had and getting away from the deficit and disparities conversation and recognizing that the DEI, this deficit and disparities conversation is a conversation that frankly belongs to somebody else. Like those aren't our conversations. We see ourselves far more complete than those narratives offer.
Yeah. I agree with all that, because I think for us in the healthcare space, we're really trying our best to create a space where people are healthy, right? Even with all the things that might be predisposed because you're a person of color, how do you live with and understand how to manage that in this place where, like you said, there's upward mobility, our education system is working for everyone. Are, you know, the having access to whatever it is you can imagine, and you don't feel hindered to go after it. That's what I think about when I think about, you know, the future and how we create it. But in the healthcare space, we're always like, how do we improve on the quality of the care we provide? How do we improve, you know, health outcomes for individuals? Like, I would like to see Black women not die and Black babies die in childbirth, right? I'd like to see that number go down. But I also want to lean into the joy it is to have a baby and not feel like I always have to be a statistic that people mm-hmm. talk about. Instead mm-hmm. of, you know, talking about it's a joy to have a baby, it's always these other things. So like you said, changing the narrative about how we talk about ourselves and how we show up in these spaces, and we have the access we need, and we have the confidence to then move into that space and own it. And then keep moving. If that's what you know, the future looks like to you.
Yes. Did either of you know my friend Yusuf Mjani? Kimberly, did you know Yusuf Mjani?
I did not. I'm sorry. No.
Justin, did you know Yusuf Mjani?
I don't want to like over exaggerate my connection with them, but what did I see recently online?
Yusuf died last week. That's number one.
He passed away. That's what I
meant to. Pay tribute to him. In fact, joining me, I don't have his video yet, but Bill Young was a personal friend of Yusuf. Bill, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
We don't have your picture, but your voice is loud and clear. Okay. Take a minute, if you would, and just talk about Yusuf Mjani, who he was, and how we owe it to ourselves to celebrate his contribution, his genius, the love he brought to community.
Hello, everybody. Yusuf was smart, well-read, funny, a family man, church goer, and he defined how he was going to live his life. And a good example of that is what he told me happened when he went to Central High School. And evidently the athletic director there at the time spotted him and said, and pulled him aside and said, it looks like we're going to have a city championship in basketball. And Yusuf smiled politely and respectfully and said that he wasn't interested in playing basketball. Well, if anybody knew Yusuf then, he was, you know, I guess about 6'4", 6'5", and... Yep. Had a huge behind on him, so he took up a lot of space around and under the basket. And I could see the athletic director that the potential that Yusuf would bring to a basketball team. But Yusuf, you know, like our relationship was one where I would kind of have to bring him back down to earth. And I think that's why he liked me so much and why I loved him so much. You know, I would, we had similar backgrounds. Our daughters were the same age and born within a week of each other. We had granddaughters that were the same age and born within a week of each other. And so I went to Catholic school. Yusef went to Catholic school and would rave about it. The Opelite sisters, what he learned from them. Mm-hmm. And we had a teasing, a bantering relationship that, you know, I would hear from him how smart he was.